I love the clean and smooth shape of Harry's razors. And I also love that they come to me monthly, so I don't even have to add them to my shopping list. Plus, only one razor with multiple blades in my shower helps me stay super neat and stops me from clogging the drain. Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades that they'll give you their trial shave set for free when you sign up at harrys.com/actual. You just pay for shipping. Harry's is all about a great shave at a fair price, which is why over 3 million people have switched to Harry's. Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys like us, were fed up with buying overpriced razors, so they started Harry's to fix shaving. All products are backed by a 100% quality guarantee. Harry's offers their blades at half the price of the leading 5-blade razor, selling directly to you over the internet. Claim your free trial offer from Harry's today, a $13 value for free when you sign up. Just cover shipping. Your free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. To get your free trial set, go to harrys.com/actual right now. That's harrys.com/actual.
Hi, my name is Joe Diaz, and I served 9 years in the California state prison system for a crime I did not commit.
Hi, this is Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast dedicated to spreading the awareness of wrongful conviction and cracks in the justice system. This week, we're talking to Joe. I met Joe at the Innocence Conference, and I continue to be impressed with his fortitude and manner in which he conducts himself every time we speak. This episode is being brought to you by Harry's Razors, Pro Flowers, and Smart Move. I just wanted to remind you that without sponsors, many independent podcasts would not be sustainable. Joe was convicted for a crime that he did not commit, but he didn't let that stand in his way of being successful in life. He was motivated to succeed, and he never gave up. This is Joe's story.
I come from a family of 7, 5 children and my parents. I had a pretty idyllic childhood. I played sports. My actual escape was through sports. I came from a very dysfunctional family. My parents are not very educated. And my escape was through school and sports.
Were you one of the older of the siblings, one of the younger of the siblings?
I am the oldest of 5.
In October of 1983, there was a crime that happened. It was an assault near where you were living.
It wasn't near. It was actually about 10 miles away in another part of town. A girl was attending night school at a certain high school, and some guy put a knife to her and took her to the back of the school. He was going to attempt to rape her until somebody came by, so he ran off.
The next year, the spring of the next year.
At the same exact school, early in the morning, a woman, an attorney, 40 years of age, was jogging at the school, and some guy attacked her, but this guy was successful in his assault. And after that was like April 1st, 1984. And then in May of that same year, a month later, I was arrested.
Do you remember?
I was in college. I was sitting in a college classroom.
Do they take you to a station? Do they question you right there? What happens next?
No, they came to, ironically enough, and this has always really haunted me because it leaves me wondering, you know, what the professor, what role he may have played in this, if any, I don't know. But the professor was a retired, I was in an administration of justice class, and the professor was a former San Jose police officer who had retired after 25 years, earned his PhD, was teaching administration of justice classes. And we had gone on a prison visit with him at San Quentin. In his classroom, the detectives walk in, and, you know, I don't think anything of it. They look like a couple of other professors who hand him the note. He walks over to my desk with the two detectives, and they walk me outside, handcuffed me, and took me downtown.
You're going downtown, and did they tell you why you were going?
Absolutely not. They just wanted to know, you know, how I got to school, where my car was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't want to tell them what my automobile was. Yes, it was parked in the parking lot, but I had a gun in the car. I wasn't going to tell them where it was. I didn't know why they were picking me up. They wouldn't tell me. I literally sat at a police station being interrogated for about 2 or 3 hours without them telling me why. They were just wanting to know where I was on certain dates. Well, I couldn't remember exactly where I was on certain dates. I wasn't keeping track. Therefore, I told them as the best I could where I was.
How old were you at that time?
I was 20 years old.
Did they ever offer you, like, a parent or an attorney?
It's been so long that I'm not 100% sure, but I know that when they, you know, I made that big mistake that most people make, I had nothing to hide. Therefore, when they read me my Miranda rights, I obviously said, you know, I'll speak to you. I have nothing to hide. What is it that you guys want? I wasn't about there was no need for me to request an attorney or anything. So I said, I waive my rights. I'll talk to you about whatever you want.
How long were you there in total? Like, how long was the interrogation process?
It must have been a minimum 2 to 3 hours before, you know, I kept asking them, what am I in here for? What am I being charged for? Do you mind telling me? You've asked me a million times where I was on certain dates. Now, will you please tell me what it is that you want with me? Because I need to get home. And they said, well, unfortunately, you're not going home because you're under arrest. I go, really? Can you at least tell me what I'm being charged with? And let me back up a little bit. During the interrogation, he kept asking me, you know, have you ever driven a van? Have you ever driven a van? What I told them was when I moved, I had rented a van, and they asked what kind of a van. I said, I don't know. It was either a Ford or a Chevy. It was an American. And I knew cars. You know, I grew up, you know, racing bikes and motorcycle cars. I was a car freak, so I knew cars. So I said, it was either a Ford or a Chevy, American-made van. And he says, oh, really? Do you know anybody else with a van? And I said, yes. You know, there are about 2 vans on my block. Not a problem, okay? That was that. When they're walking me from the, when they finally tells me that what I'm being charged with, I go, you got to be kidding, man. You got to come up with something better than that. You want to charge me with something. Come up with something that's realistic, that somebody could believe that I could have committed, but not something, you know, not a sexual assault. And as he's walking to the county jail, I remember my girlfriend's brother owns a Volkswagen van. Okay, and that was critical right there because quickly, and they got in. I didn't notice till later. They went and they checked out his van and took pictures of it and interviewed him and wanted to know if I had ever driven the van. Well, I had never driven the van. He had given me a ride once to the gym or from the gym. I forget. It's been so long ago. But his van was like from the 1960s. It was an old, you know, the old model. Supposedly the culprit of this van was driving a Volkswagen van, but a more modern one. It was a brand spanking new one. So it had nothing to do with his, but that was critical. And they try to use that as, oh, well, this guy has, you know, ties to a van.
They arrest you. And then what happens next?
Well, I'm sitting in the county jail and I can't believe this. You know what I mean? Obviously, you go from total shock. They're trying to piece things together. They're trying to think exactly where might I have been on these dates that these guys are talking about. And I couldn't remember for the life of me. I started thinking, where was I? Where was I? So I started reaching out to my friends. Where could I have been on this day, on that day? And then some of my friends that I used to ride motorcycles with knew exactly where we were. It was a Sunday. Now that I come to think about it, now that I remember, because the minister of the church that He rode motorcycles, and so did our other friends that were roommates. One of my friends was a roommate with the minister. I used to go to their church every now and then, and it was a distance away. So we would always ride motorcycles together. So he remembered that we had, it's been so long. I'm not sure if we had gone to church that day or we had gone on a motorcycle ride. It's been so long. But that is... They're the ones who looked at their calendars and said, oh, this is what we were doing that day. And so they went to court and they testified to it, including the minister, you know, but obviously he wasn't believed either. When the April attack took place, I was either in church with these gentlemen or I was riding motorcycles with them. Back in October of the previous year, I couldn't remember where I was that evening.
I can't remember where I was yesterday, you know, evening. How long were you kept before you got your trial?
I was in the county jail for about 10 months. The trial took place in about 2 weeks, and like a day after I was convicted, I was shipped out to the prison system because I got into a fight with a guy. and a stupid, worthless fight, but nevertheless, it was a fight, so they figured, well, that's usually when people have nothing to lose, they've already been convicted, that's when fights break out, so they figured they're going to, you know, they're going to get more fighting out of me, so they figured, ship them out.
So your trial was 2 weeks?
2 weeks to the day, if you will, because it started on a Monday, and then it ended on a Wednesday, and then by Friday, the jurors wanted to go home for the weekend, so it was like, hey, you know, they needed to end it right there on Friday. So they ended it on a Friday and they were gone.
How long did the jury deliberate?
From Wednesday to Friday morning. So it was really one day. They deliberated on Thursday, and then on Friday morning they came back and found me guilty.
I'm trying to imagine, you know, you knowing you're an innocent person and having the I'm going to tell the truth mentality. What did you feel when they said it?
Oh, I was definitely shocked because I again, like almost every other exoneree, you feel if you, you know, if the laws that we live by in this country, you know, what this country stands for, you're going to sit here and you're going to put your trust in the justice system. You're going to tell the truth. You're going to walk out of that courtroom. I thought for sure once the victims sit there in court and see me, you know what I mean, or hear my voice, which they never got to hear. Once they see me, they're going to realize this isn't the guy. You know what I mean? I'm going home. That didn't happen. I figured, you know, once you take any of my, they took saliva to do, they didn't have DNA tests back then. That's why I'm free now. But back then, they didn't have it in 1984. So they took saliva and did something called PGM testing, whatever that was about. I figured once that comes back, I'm going home because they'll figure out it wasn't me. So I thought, you know, I'm walking out here once I go to court. I didn't even think I was even going to make it to jury trial, to be honest with you. I thought before we even made it to a pretrial that I was going to the judges, the lawyers, the police were going to figure out they have the wrong guy. So that's what my mindset was. But as I sat there in the county jail for so many months, I started realizing, well, wait a minute, you know, this is serious. These guys, this game is getting a lot more serious now than I thought. So I started preparing myself. If these guys actually find me guilty, I'm running out of that courtroom. I'm going to escape. Well, guess what? When they said guilty, my legs turned up butter. There was no way I was in total shock. I wasn't going to run anywhere. I couldn't. My body was in total. I was paralyzed. That's how I was. So that was my mentality. I'm walking out of here. These folks, you know, they're going to have to realize that I'm not a guilty party. So it's not a problem. If there is a problem, I'm running out of this courtroom. Well, I wasn't going to run anywhere because you pretty much could have just considered me paralyzed at the point. I was in complete total shock.
You said that the jury didn't get to hear your voice. Did you want to testify?
Oh, that's another. I'm glad you asked. I wanted to testify so badly, but my attorney at the time, and this was a paid attorney. This isn't, you know, people always badmouth the public defenders this, public defenders that. Now, in hindsight, I wish I would have had a public defender because this was an attorney that we paid cash to. And not only did we pay cash to, but then after that, he went back to my ex-wife and said, you know, I did such a great job. Joe only received 15 years. You should give me his car because I had just purchased a brand new little Mazda RX-7, a little sports car. And he wanted that car. He literally, because while he was investigating where I may have been back in October, I said, well, I just purchased that car back in October. Go to the car lot. See if I was there that day. I don't know. I don't remember where I bought it. I just know it was purchased in that month. So he literally saw the car and he took that opportunity. Such an unethical individual, went back to my ex-wife and said, you know, I did such a great job. I only got him 15 years. I believe I deserve that car. So go figure. So I wanted to testify so much, and all he can tell me was, you know what, you look like a very angry, mean guy. I don't think I want to put you up on the stand because you're going to scare the jurors. I go, are you kidding me? I'm going to scare the jurors? I need to speak the truth. I'm being accused of something I didn't do. I need to defend myself. He goes, I've been doing this for many years. I'm a former prosecutor. I know what I'm talking about. You're going to scare the jury. You look like a scary guy. You look so angry and so bitter. I go, I have every right in the world to be angry and bitter, mister. But the point is, I need to tell my story. He talked me out of it. And I was very vulnerable. I was vulnerable to this man because, you know, of course, you know, I grew up in the hood. This guy, you know, has gone to law school. He was a former prosecutor. Here he is. He's supposed to be one of the best in town. I had to respect his opinion, and that's what I went with, his opinion. And it did me in, but what could I do? But believe in him and trust in the jury. And by the way, you asked how long did the jury deliberate. It really, I thought the jury was going to deliberate even longer once they figured out one of the jurors was asleep through most of the jury trial. He tried to get off the jury. He couldn't get off the jury. So he sat in the jury. He sat through it for those 2 weeks, practically sleeping throughout the whole jury. And I thought he would be my only hope, because, you know, I am Hispanic. The jury was all white, with the exception of this one African-American male, but he slept throughout the whole darn jury trial. So I thought, my God, mister, wake up. I'm being, you know, laid out. I'm being sacrificed. Please wake up. So I thought for sure this guy was going to at least be kicked off the jury and they would deliberate a little longer. It didn't happen.
That I can't believe a sleeping person was allowed to be part of the deliberations.
I agree with you, but, you know, there were so many more facts. You know, they start to add up. And you don't see them when you're 20 years old, in shock, you know, that this is happening to you. You don't see through this stuff. At the time, I thought my lawyer would have done such a great job. I thought this guy is a genius. You know, guys back in the jailhouse were asking me, how is your lawyer? You know, I need a good lawyer, da 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 da. I said, man, this guy is great. He's, you know, you should see him up there. He's just doing such a great job. And in hindsight, that guy was a dump truck. I mean, he literally just didn't do anything for me. I literally came out one day because, you know, what they do when they take you to court, they have these, like, catacombs, like these dungeons beneath the jailhouse, and that's where they transport all the prisoners. That's why the general public never sees the prisoners coming in and out of the court, because they're underneath the buildings. And they pulled me up one day up the elevator and pulled me out going to a courtroom, and I saw him coming out of a room where the district attorney was and the judge. And I thought to myself, what is going on here? Because his face turned red when he saw me. And I said, wait a minute, you know. In hindsight, I thought, wait a minute, right there, I should have just killed our relationship. But I didn't know. I asked him, what was that? You know, you're sitting here meeting with the devil. I think I literally told him, you're sitting there, you know, discussing my case with the devil. This is not right. There's a conflict of interest here. And he assured me this is, you know, common protocol. We're just discussing the case, da 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 da. I don't know. I wasn't in the room. I don't know what the conversation was about, but that should have been a hint to me to say, we need to cut ties here. I need a different attorney. But I didn't know. Again, I was very susceptible. I was very vulnerable because I was walking around like a zombie. Here I was, a young fool, laying all my trust in him.
You said you got 15 years.
Exactly.
What was prison like?
Well, as I mentioned to you before, that I came from a very dysfunctional family. We came to this country as refugees. Therefore, my parents didn't speak English. My parents didn't have good jobs. We lived in the worst of the worst neighborhoods. Therefore, and again, I was a student and I was an athlete. Because I was an athlete and I knew that I had to have certain grades, I knew that I had to maintain the grades so that I can play sports. Plus, I liked school. So I liked going to school and I liked playing my sports. In an effort to do so, I had to, you know, walk through gang territory. So I was always fighting the gangs, fighting the gangbangers, fighting all these dudes that, you know, wanted me to be part of their hood. If I wasn't part of it, then I was against it, et cetera, et cetera. So it was no, prison to me was nothing more than an extension of the madness that I had already grown up with and around in my neighborhood. So it didn't faze me that much. The worst thing, a lot of people believe that prison is so bad. You have all these criminals, you have all these mean guys. I did not and I would not ever join a gang. That's not part of me. I've always detested gangs and gang culture. So I carried my own self through the prison. I was my own self. I kept myself busy with school. I kept myself busy exercising. I've always been an athlete, so I always kept myself in shape. And I love basketball, so I was always on the basketball court playing my basketball. The worst part of prison for me was not necessarily the prison culture or the prison inmates. It was the control that the guards had over us, the control of telling me when I can eat, when I can use the restroom, when I can shower, you know, that is what killed me more than anything. And obviously being away from my family, I had two little daughters at the time. I couldn't see them, but, you know, in the visiting room every so often and knowing that I was sitting in there for something I didn't do, that was the worst part. I mean, and looking at these cops, I mean, they're, believe me, Look, I didn't believe in prisons before being railroaded. I believe that every man and woman should be rehabilitated, until I got to prison. Then I realized, wow, we need prison, because there are a lot of guys, you know, that are never going to change. And some of the stories that I heard from some of these guys, they were just so awful. I realized, you know, we do need prisons, because some of these folks are never going to change their ways. However, just because I was around bad men did not mean that I did not also see the other side of the story. I looked at some of the worst behavior in prison was being conducted by the guards, okay? Now, don't get me wrong, 100% of them weren't bad. There were a lot of decent men and women who came in and out of those prisons on a daily basis, who were there to do a job and were there to uphold, you know, justice, if you will, and do the best that they could to feed their family. They treated you like a human being. They treated you with respect, and you reciprocated. However, there were the jerks that were in there, and they, you know, the punks, as we used to say, the punks, the little bitches who had their lunches stolen from them, the money taken from them when they were in grade school, who now have a position of power and wish to exercise it and abuse people and you know, miscarry their power. Those are the individuals. That's what pissed me off the most about prison life, of anything, were those guards that I just bumped heads with, you know. But by the same token, I met so many men in there that were such good people, good, hard, I'm sure that they were good, hardworking people on the streets, because I went to college with a lot of them inside of there, who worked very hard on their education, who worked hard in the jobs, decent individuals, you know, that society just threw away for one reason or another. A lot of the guys that I was in college with were lifers, and this kills me, because I've been to a few different conventions and things at various different universities where people discuss, should we educate convicts? Who should, and if so, who do we utilize our finances on the lifers, or the people, or the short termers, on the guys who have attacked children, or somebody who's, you know, just robbed an ice cream truck, you know, et cetera. And it ticks me off, because you don't know who that individual is that you are educating. You never know if that person is innocent, if that person is guilty, if that person can be rehabilitated. If we call our prison system the Department of Corrections, then we should be in rehabilitation, then we should be looking at rehabilitation and not just, you know, warehousing men like a bunch of sardines. We should be men and women. We should be really putting our focus on rehabilitating that population of individuals, no matter what their crime, because guess what? They may or may not have committed the crime. And even if they did commit the crime, 95% of those men and women that return to your neighborhood, they may just be your neighbor. So it is best to have these folks educated and rehabilitated than just warehoused and not being prodded and turned into, you know, wild animals, and then have them come out and be your neighbor.
I think that was amazing. That's the most amazing and closest to my perspective that I've ever heard anyone on this show say. That you're absolutely right. Do you think that, okay, so you sent me an email earlier talking about the schooling and education that you got in prison. Do you think that because you were self-motivated, that's part of the reason why you were able to succeed with that? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know exactly what you mean, because I've been asked many a times. I mean, it is no secret amongst those who know my family, those who know me, they always ask the same question. How come you're so different? How come you turned out? How come you were able to succeed when the rest of your siblings didn't? And I was motivated, and I give all credit to sports. I am of the belief that sports are what gave me the foundation to teach me that the human body can, the human mind can overcome anything before you. Because when you're in competition, when you're in the heat of battle, you're going to rely on muscle memory of whatever you practice. Okay? So the sports that I practiced as a young man, and the martial arts that I got involved in at a later age, taught me that the more that I can discipline my mind, discipline my body, the further it's going to take me. The more that I can conquer, the more that I can persevere. So that is what allowed me to to persevere, if you will. And because I was framed at the time, we can get to this. I believed I was framed. I was led to believe later that the cops made an innocent mistake. However it happened, the point is, because I knew that I did not commit the crime that I was sitting in prison for, I was not about to just sit in there and hold on a job for the state, working for the man to forward their cause. I was not going to do it. So I was going to do everything within my power to be a better me, to educate myself. Okay. And since I had already started, I was already attending a junior college when I was arrested, abducted, framed, however you wish to word it. I knew that I needed to continue on that. And I was fortunate at the time that the college programs were being offered. So I was able to enroll and work towards my college degree. And the reason I did so is, again, those values that were instilled in me playing sports my entire life. I had great coaches, and people ask a lot of times, and it was funny because I ran into one of those coaches at my daughter's school. He was no longer teaching at the school that I attended junior high school, but he was teaching at another junior high school. And I gave him a compliment without even knowing it until he thanked me. I forget what the question was, but I told him, I repeated to him that the story that I tell people is that I was successful because I had a very strict German and two very strict Japanese coaches who really instilled excellent values in me. And this gentleman just sits there and said, well, thank you. And it dawned on me, I'm giving this man a compliment without even, you know, being conscious of it. So I have to say that is what gave me it wasn't even the knowledge, because I really wasn't even conscious of it at the time, but it was the subconscious, the subliminal, you know, fortitude to keep going and keep pushing myself to be something better. And in the process of taking these courses, because believe me, we could not choose what courses we were going to take. We had to accept whatever courses were given to us. So I was given courses that really enlightened me. You know, art history, I would never have taken art history for the life of me. Never would have taken it. I am so glad that that course was given to me, because through art history, I learned an appreciation of history, an appreciation of art, which led to an appreciation then of geography and political geography and so on and so on. It was one milestone after another, and I was like, wow. So my eyes started to open. I started to expand my horizons, and I wouldn't have been able to do that had I not had sat in the classroom. I definitely wouldn't have done it if I would have become bitter and just remained on the prison yard and lifted weights and played basketball day in and day out. No, it wasn't going to happen.
So, okay, I might cut this out, but I'm just really interested in your perspective in this. You said that, you know, like probably 95% of the people in prison could be rehabilitated, but they're not. So how do you give them what you have? How do you think you can motivate people who have never had a reason to be motivated? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I don't believe, yes, no, I know exactly what you mean. I didn't say that 95% of the people can be rehabilitated, but 95% of the folks in prison are going to get out. I'm not sure what percentage can be rehabilitated, because a lot of it comes from your own fortitude, what you're willing to give. You have to put some skin into the game in order to get something out of it. So, and unfortunately, there are a lot of folks who give up on themselves for whatever reason, and a lot of it could just be low self-esteem. That is one common denominator that I recognize about a lot of the men in prison. A lot of them have such low self-esteem for whatever reason, you know, whether it was poverty, abuse, whether it was physical or mental, et cetera, lack of education, I don't know. But because they don't have it, you know, whatever, you know, they could have a flipped chromosome and you don't have what it takes. You've been ridiculed as a kid, et cetera. And they turn to drugs, to alcohol, to whatever they do, that you cannot get so many of these men on the track to make a decision. Hey, you have to do something for yourself in order to better yourself in life. And so I'm not sure that you can I don't know because I haven't had the success with my own family. Let me be honest with you, because I have not been able to. And I tell my siblings all the time, we come from the same background. We come from the same parents. We've experienced the same hardships. Look at what I've been through. If I can do it, you can do it. Please educate yourself. Lay off the drugs. Lay off the alcohol. Educate your mind. You don't even have to go to a school. Pick up a newspaper. Pick up a book. Utilize your mind so that you can be a better individual. Not only will you be a better individual for yourself, but look at the example that you will set for your children. And I have not been successful in being able to convey that message to my own siblings so much, you know. But so I couldn't say what percentage of the prison population could happen to, but it's not going to stop me from trying. And that's one thing. I am, you know, in a couple of weeks here, I will be going up to a prison, and I'm going to try to become part of get the training so that I can become a mentor, if you will, in these groups and an advocate to try to convey to these men that, hey, there is a life after prison. There is more to life than just getting out of here and believing that, you know, all roads are closed to you. You can make something of your life, but you have to do it as soon as possible. You know, just because life does not stand still for anybody, especially nowadays when technology moves so quickly, you have to continue to educate yourself on a daily basis almost at times.
So how long did you spend in prison?
9 years. Nine long years.
9 years. And you were paroled, is that correct? Did I read that right?
Yes, I was paroled, and I was in from 84 to 93, and then it wasn't until 2012 that I was exonerated. And perhaps I could have been exonerated much sooner because, DNA testing did not exist back in 1984, but once it became, not that I had written plenty of agencies, the ACLU, the Public Defender's Office, the District Attorney, I had written everybody and anybody who could, I thought, would be able to help me back in the 80s. Nobody would help me. Once I started reading about DNA tests being invented, I then started reaching out to, I don't even remember who, about, hey, how can I get a DNA test? I have nothing to hide. Can I please get a DNA test? And everybody kept turning me down. Well, how much money do you have? Can you afford to pay this? I go, obviously, I'm sitting in prison. I can't afford to do anything. But, you know, I am an innocent man. I have nothing to prove. Let science prove it. Here I am. And nobody heard me out. So I had gone through two attorneys since I had gotten out to try to get my case back in front of the district attorney's office to try to get me a DNA test. And actually, let me back up. Before I even hired any attorneys, when I first got out back in 93, I contacted all these agencies again. Everybody turned their back on me. Everybody kept telling me, go back to the district attorney, go back to the district attorney. I'm like, are you crazy? I'm going back to the devil that convicted me. It's not gonna bear any fruit. But I didn't have a choice. I didn't have a choice. So I contacted the district attorney, and the same district attorney who convicted me, he didn't want to see me, but at least he set up a meeting with his investigator. And I went to the district attorney's office and I met with his investigator, and I told him that I had nothing to hide. Please run a DNA test. And he was more concerned with the price and this and this and that. I go, if you are working for the public here, if the public is paying your salary, please, in the interest of justice, take my blood, run a DNA test. And I didn't know this at the time, but, you know, I don't know what he was doing, you know, through all the interrogation that he was doing. But obviously he had premeditated some of his thought process, because he had a nurse come in. The nurse took my blood. You know, he made it sound like, okay, well, now that I've had this conversation with you, we're willing to run a test. A nurse will be here pretty soon. So the nurse came, took my blood. And before I was ready to leave, both that investigator and the nurse wished me well and wished me luck. And I was like, wait a minute, did I hear that? Because, you know, to me, it was always an adversarial, you know, contentious relationship between the district attorney's side and the defense side. So I didn't expect that coming from them. So I got a little hopeful and I thought, wow, they're wishing me well, you know. They may have believed me, so this may be good for me. Unfortunately, I never heard back from them, so I kept calling, writing, And back then there was no email. I think it was just about sending in snail mail and calling until I guess the DA got fed up with me and had the investigator call me and say, hey, the DNA test comes back inconclusive. And I thought, you dirty dog, then give me a copy of it. And they wouldn't give it to me. To this day, they have not given me a copy of the DNA test. So I said, well, there's got to be something. There's got to be more. Something more has got to be done here. So I never gave up. I kept persevering. I hired one attorney who then, because one of my sister-in-laws was working for him, and she told me what a great guy he was, This guy didn't do much but write a letter, because I wanted to assure the district attorney's office I wasn't trying to sue anyone. I wasn't trying to make any news or, make any waves. I just want to clear my name. I have nothing to hide. Therefore, please consider this signature here and this waiver that I am not trying to sue anyone. I don't want you to sue anyone. Please, I need to clear my name. So the only thing that attorney ever did for the money I paid him was submit, mail that letter off to them. Okay.
Can I stop you for just a second? Can you tell me what, because you had to register as a sex offender when you left prison, correct?
Absolutely. What a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to ask. What was that like? Like, what did that mean?
Well, let me back up even further. When I was released from prison, the parole officer called me one day or sent me a letter. I forget how it went. And they tell me that I have to go join some sort of a medical study group to help me be less of a sex offender. I said, are you kidding me? He says, no, you're going to have to attend this workshop or you're going back to prison. I said, I don't know how many times I got to tell you guys this, but I have never been and I will never be a sex offender. Therefore, I will not, I am not going to do this. Therefore, you can send me back to prison right now because there's no way I'm going to take these courses. I'm not going to be part of it. I'm not going to play this game anymore. And I don't know what happened, but the parole officer never came back to me with that suggestion ever again. So that was way back in 93 upon my release. And I served the 3 years because obviously if you're not admitting to a crime, then they figure they have to max you out on your parole time. I had to serve the whole 3 years, despite what, the stellar record that I had.
Last month I was in the hospital. And let me tell you, that's not a fun experience. But my friend Christy knows how to cheer a girl up because she sent me pro flowers and they were beautiful. Even the vase was amazing. I loved every part of it. I think the surprise was one of the best parts. It was a gift I wasn't even expecting. Pro Flowers wants to help you surprise someone for no reason at all, while also surprising you with a special deal for my listeners. Get 20% off any of their unique summer rose bouquets or any other bouquet of $29 or more. Their colorful rainbow roses are always a hit if you aren't sure what to send someone. Pro Flower bouquets are guaranteed to stay fresh for at least 7 days or your money back, and you control the delivery date. Pro Flowers gives you more bloom for your buck. Big, beautiful flowers with more stems for your money. To get 20% off summer roses or any other bouquet of $29 or more, go to Pro Flowers and use my code AI at checkout. That's proflowers.com and code AI. Don't wait to make somebody's day. Thanks, Christy.
Going to school and working, a serious family man, they didn't care. They kept me on parole for the 3 years. Nevertheless, I had to register as a sex offender, and I was up on their registry, and it wasn't a problem because only the police had knowledge of this until 2005, I believe, whenever they made it public to the general public. And when they made it public, oh my goodness, that was a nightmare. I mean, I was literally at work on my lunch break reading the paper, and there it was. As of today, this database is being made to the general, being made public. My heart dropped. It was like, here it goes again. I am reliving this nightmare once again. So long story short, I was on that page from whenever they made it public, I think it was 2005 until 2012, 2012 is when late 2012, when I was fully exonerated and it was removed. But I even had neighbors ask me, you know, like, hey, what's going on? You know, I understand that you're having problems with the other neighbors down closer to you because of this and because of that, because you're on that web page. And it was terrible. It was so embarrassing. I always worried, I actually lost a job because of it, during a background check. It was figured that they found me on that webpage. I didn't get the job. Some of my friends, to this day, I don't know which of my friends even have seen me on that page or when I was still on there and have never mentioned anything. But some of my close friends saw me on that page and actually kept it secret. They didn't tell me anything about it. They actually pulled my wife over and they said, hey, we know of this. What happened? You know what I mean? And she explained to them. And these friends, these are true friends, because they literally sat there and told her, well, you know what? We don't want to scare him. We don't want him to think that we're not his real friends. We can tell by his character that he doesn't carry himself like that type of an individual. So don't tell him anything. We want to spend some time with him, and we're going to break it to him sooner or later. But we need to be able to let him gain our trust to know that he's on there, you know, that we know about it, that we saw him. And that's the way it broke down. One day we were, you know, sitting around, we had dinner, we were having some wine, and I believe it was the husband who brought it up. He says, hey, you know, what happened? You know, we saw you up on that webpage and da 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 da. And to me, I was in shock because I looked over at my wife. And then he could tell that I was like angry, like what's going on, and she knew about it, and I was angry with her because she withheld it from me. I go, how could you do this to me? And that's when I believe our friend's wife interjected and said, hey, listen, we wanted you to gain our trust to understand that we're not passing judgment on you. We just wanted to clear the air first of all. Don't be mad at her. We wanted to establish this. And at the time, I was furious because I was very angry at my wife. I was thinking, how could you withhold something from me? I almost felt like, you know, as if she had cheated on me. That's how I felt, you know. And, of course, I think differently now, you know, in hindsight. But at the moment, I was in shock. So when these friends came straight out and told me this and accepted me for the individual and the character that they had gotten to know, that told me right there, well, not everybody is so close-minded. People are able to have an open mind, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, that was, I can't even remember when, but let's say it was 5 years prior to my exoneration. When I was exonerated, I was more than happy to share with them the transcripts of my court transcripts, et cetera, and what I had been through. And, you know, they said, yeah, well, we believe you all along because we can tell by your character, you know, you're very, you know, ethical, honest individual that wouldn't sit here and lie to us about something so serious. And being on that webpage was not a very, very good feeling. It was awful. But on top of that, while we're on this topic, after I was exonerated, it was like, and trust me, I am currently in therapy because I thought that after being exonerated, I was, you know, I was going to be in heaven. Everything was going to be so beautiful. And I was for a little bit. I was for a little bit. Then all of a sudden, all this anger returned. And I became fierce. And I wanted to fight all the time. I just started drinking. And my wife was asking me, what is wrong with you? I thought once you were exonerated, you were going to be a different person. You're going to be a happier person. And it took a toll on my family, my sons. My daughters are adults now, so they weren't around. My wife, it was taking a toll. My poor friends, you know, they were seeing it. After I had a few drinks, I was exploding. They didn't know what was wrong with me. And everybody's like, what is wrong with you? You should be happy. But here's one thing that happened. Once the district attorney exonerated me, all of a sudden I get a letter in the mail from the attorney general's office stating that I had to re-register as a sex offender because the district attorney were, in essence, activist district attorneys and activist judges, and they had no jurisdiction over me. How dare they exonerate me? And the district attorney is pushing back, fighting them, saying, are you crazy? This county made the mistake and falsely incarcerated a man We therefore had the jurisdiction. We went back and we were able to find evidence that it wasn't him. Therefore, we have cleared him. Of course, we have jurisdiction. This is the county that sent this innocent man to prison. And the attorney general was fighting it tooth and nail. And I don't know for how long this took. I forget how long it took now, but the bottom line is that it, like the therapist was able to, because my wife and I couldn't figure it out, you know what I mean, until the therapist put it in black and white. She said, hey, listen, you were exonerated. You were on a honeymoon. These guys, the attorney general's office pulled this little trick, and all of a sudden your honeymoon was over. And once your honeymoon was over, you were reliving your nightmare all over again. And it was like we were too close to the forest for the trees. We could not see what had, you know, resurfaced all this anger. And that was it, pretty much. It was because of what the attorney general had been doing. And I was so angry because I believed that I had been framed. But then after going through my exoneration hearings and such, I believed the district attorney and his investigator and everything they had to say, that I was not framed, that it was just, you know, good cops who made a mistake. And so it took a ton, took 500 pounds of weight off my shoulders, realizing I was not framed. These guys just made an honest mistake. Okay, I can live with it. I can move forward. I can now live my life. And then the attorney general doing that, it hit me so hard. Exactly. And it hit me so hard that I wasn't even aware of what had brought all this anger back and surfaced. And trust me, my anger had kind of helped me through prison, because prison is not a walk in the park. So the anger and my formal fighting, you know, background helped me through prison. But I had pretty much had shelved it. I had, you know, put myself into my books and accepting the fact that I'm going to have to do the best that I can. Of course, I did contemplate trying to escape, but I figured if I escape and I try to escape and I'm shot trying to escape, what is going to happen to my four daughters? At the time, I had two daughters with my first wife. I figured, you know, I'm not going to be there for them. They're going to grow up without a father. I cannot take that risk. I must be a man. I must man up. I had to. My father did it. My father was a military man in Cuba, and he had to cut sugarcane free labor to get us into this country. So I figured if he can do that, he manned up. It is time for me to man up and make sure that no matter what these people try to do, they cannot win. I'm going to be the bigger man. I'm going to persevere at any cost to make sure that I'm there for my children. That's just the way it's going to be. And that's what I did, to make sure that I was there for my children. So.
No, I interrupted you when you were after your sister-in-law had recommended an attorney, and you said that all they did was write a letter, and that was when I interrupted you.
Oh, yes. So that my sister-in-law recommended the attorney that she was working for, and she sold me on how good of an attorney he was and all his connections, da-da-da-da-da. Well, I was desperate. You know, I figured I'd hire this man. And he didn't do much but just send that one letter, and then he kept never returning my phone call. I said, what is wrong with this guy? I mean, this is a common MO with these attorneys. They'll take your check, but once they have your check, they don't return your calls. So when he wouldn't return my calls, I started showing up at his office. He was never there. I could never get past. My sister-in-law was no longer his paralegal, so I couldn't get past the new paralegal. I said, what is going on with this guy? Until one day I was able to catch him in his office, and he told me, you know what? I'm too busy. I now have a teaching job at a university, da 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 da. But I'm going to recommend you to a very good colleague of mine, who and she is an activist and very highly respected, da 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 da. And I met with this attorney and gave her a check too. That's always the biggest problem, giving an attorney a check, because all of a sudden they're.
You need to forget to sign it, so you have to come back or something.
Exactly. But I didn't dawn on me. I wish I would have been wiser then. So after giving her a check, what did she do? She became pretty active. She was the only attorney who got up and went down to the police evidence locker room or whatever, wherever they hold the evidence, and tried to see if there was any evidence left on my case so that we can test it and get a DNA test. And they told her, no, all the evidence in his case was destroyed back in 1990 when his appeals had expired or exhausted. And I thought, oh my God, at least she did that. But after that, she stopped returning my calls. And I kept showing up at her office and never there either, never, and even sending registered mail, sending certified mail. Hey, I need you to give me a response. What's going on here? Anyways, I never heard from her again. And ironically enough, I had put a lot of tattoos on me in prison just out of sheer rebellion. I was just, you know, I didn't think I was ever going to get out. I was like, F the world. I had tattooed myself. And later on, after I was out, I realized how counterproductive that was, you know, in my career, et cetera. So I started removing them. And I'm at the dermatologist's office getting my tattoos removed one day, and I walk in, and the room was frozen cold. And, you know, your defense mechanisms kick in when it's cold. So I knew that laser is going to hurt. So I asked the nurse what's going on and stuff like that. Well, she just didn't tell me, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. She said, well, you know, the reality is that haven't you watched the news? And I go, yeah, what's the problem? She goes, didn't you see this guy, Gerald Schwartz, back at the, and I said, oh yeah, this guy Buddy that he just freed. And he said, yes, he, you know, it turns out that this attorney is Jewish, and he freed a guy who had a swastika on him. So when he was visiting the court, he tells him, hey, listen, not if, but when I get you out of this prison, you need to remove that swastika. And the guy agreed. Long story short, he gets the guy out of prison. The guy was actually innocent. While he was at this doctor's office getting the tattoo removed, I guess he was coming back, because the first scene that I'd seen on the news was them at the doctor's office. They were coming back this time with the reporter from the newspaper to remove more, because you don't get these tattoos removed on one visit. It takes multiple visits. And on one of those, oh my God, it hurt 10 times more coming off than it did going on, and it cost 100 times more. But that's just the way it goes. And it wasn't just a tattoo. I was fully shirted. I don't know if you know what that means, but when you're fully shirted, it means both arms and your entire torso, back and front. So I was fully shirted. So it took over 25 years to remove. It's been a long, long journey. But sitting there as I'm, so I'm asking the nurse why it's so cold. And she told me, well, the reporters are going to be here, da 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 da. You know what I mean? And as I'm walking out of the office after I had my treatment, who's sitting there but that attorney? Oh, by the way, that had happened one visit. A few visits later, I'm coming out of the because I try to look this guy up. I mean, I looked him up, but the name was so esoteric to me, and it was so long. I was like, how do you spell Schwartzbach? That's a long name. It has too many vowels, da 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 da. I was able to find him. However, I found him. So he and I were in contact, both snail mail and voicemail. We were playing phone tag back and forth, and we couldn't meet. Then all of a sudden, when I ran into him and I was leaving, I just had my treatment. He was sitting there with a reporter from the newspaper in the lobby, and we were talking, and I wasn't going to let this man get away. I'm like, I need your assistance. So I sat there, and I stood right in front of him, and he's talking and talking with the reporter. He looks up at me and he goes, yes, can I help you? I go, are you Jerry Schwartzbach? And he goes, I am. I said, I'm Joe Diaz. And he says, oh my God. He practically jumped out of his seat, pulled out his Palm Pilot, is what he had at the time. It's funny because his son helped do some of the habeas corpus work. And when I told his son the story, his son's like, oh, I remember that Palm Pilot. And his son is like his tech support who would help him with all this stuff. And he brought it up. I remember that Palm Pilot. And so it was part of the memory of the incident. From that day on, we were in contact. We exchanged, you know, our contact information again, and we were in contact. And the attorney, I was able to hire him. He was able to get me another DNA test, despite the fact. So let me back up. Because all the evidence had been destroyed, I kept telling him, but listen, my attorney at the time, back in 1984, had sent some of the evidence off to be tested at an independent lab. Contact that individual. And because the district attorney's office or the police department, whoever, destroyed all her evidence. We didn't have that. But because this independent doctor is a professional, he literally saved it and had it.
A landlord's number one concern is being paid on time by tenants. How do you know if your tenant has great credit or repeatedly pays their bills late? Evicting a tenant can cost as much as $3,500 and takes as long as 4 weeks to complete. How would you know about any of this? Let me tell you about Smart Move and find out what you don't know about your rental applicants and how you can save 25% off your next tenant screening. It's convenient. It's 100% online and accessible from all devices. You can sign up in a matter of minutes and start screening. You get fast results. Reports are delivered within minutes. It's a low cost, no fees, no minimums, pay per use. And there's an option to charge the renter for the screening, which makes it free to you. It's also good for renters. It doesn't impact their credit score because it's a soft inquiry. It's fast, and a renter's personal information, such as social security number, is kept private and secure. If you own a rental property or know someone who does, try Smart Move so you don't find out the hard way that a prospective tenant is an eviction risk. Go to tenantscreening.com, enter code INNOCENT, and get 25% off your next screening. Don't be in the dark about your applicant's rental history. Know your tenants with Smart Move tenant checks. Go to tenantscreening.com and enter my code INNOCENT and get started. With Smart Move, you'll get great reports, great convenience, and great tenants.
He wanted to get paid for his work. And I said, as it should be, the district attorney should pay for it. In the interest of justice, pay for that test, number one, and pay this man. He needs to be paid. He has frozen this. He has had to pay bills to have this, you know, not just mine, but everybody else's evidence, because he's one of the authorities and DNA stuff up here, I guess, in the country, okay? Because I saw him on the Innocence Project's webpage after the Innocence conference this year. I just happened to Google him. I wonder, is this guy still alive? Let me see if I can Google him, you know? And I Googled him, and it turns out that he had spoken at one of the Innocence conferences some time back. And I was, like, in shock, because I was like, wow, this guy is still around. But he still had this evidence. So however, the bottom line is he was not paid, but the district attorney was still able to run some sort of a DNA test. And obviously it excludes me because I'm not the individual. But in their investigation, there are so many twists and turns. I found out later that during the time before that I was abducted, and while I was in jail and while I was in prison, the district attorney's office was not aware of this, but the San Jose Police Department in Santa Clara, various different agencies, had set up a task force to catch this guy that they had called the red car rapist. And here they had this task force that had never spoken to the district attorney's office. They had never told him, you know, we have this task force, we're looking for this guy. The district attorney could have told him, oh, well, we have him, you know, and they would have told him, well, we can't because he's still committing the crimes. So It turns out, I mean, there were so many twists and turns. Oh my God, I lost track.
No, we were just talking about how the DNA expert had kept your DNA through like all the years, and so they compared your DNA to the DNA that he had kept from your case. Is that right?
No, they never did, and that they still that DNA is still being held by that gentleman, okay? And he's one of the foremost authorities on DNA in the country. So I've always said, you know, if I come into a lot of money, and I mean disposable money, not the money that I earn now. I'm not gonna, yes, not money I need to live, but disposable money. I'm gonna pay that man to have that DNA tested because I want to find who this individual is, because I'm not the only victim here. There are two women who were also, well, one who was attacked, one who was almost attacked. They need justice too, okay? They need their justice. Therefore, this individual continued to commit these crimes, and there was no circling around between this task force and the district attorney's office. And the district attorney now believes that this gentleman may have died because they can't find him in the CODIS database. The CODIS database is the national DNA database of convicted individuals whose blood they collect. So they cannot find this individual. So they believe that he died. Well, what I have learned since, that there are a couple of states, one of them being Nevada, which, you know, borders California, that do not share their CODIS database with the rest of the country. And I just can't fathom the thought that that the rest of this country would allow at least two states in our union to not share this information. This guy could be sitting in a prison, you know, because usually guys who commit this type of crime, they're sickles. They continue to commit these types of crimes, okay? They don't change. So therefore, I have a feeling that son of a gun is sitting in a prison in Nevada somewhere, and I just want that darn database to be made public. So we have to advocate to make sure that we push to get Nevada and whatever that other, I think it was Wisconsin or something. I don't recall. It was one of those Midwestern up north states that does not.
It's probably Indiana. That's where I am.
I'm not 100% sure, but I just know that it was up in that, you know, geographically I placed it up there, and I'm like, oh my God, how could they not? So I wish to push that, you know, please make these states contribute that information, even if it's because they don't have the budget to do so. Hey, there's plenty of we spend plenty of money on missiles and dropping them, you know, on people around the world. Hey, let's do something for justice here. But I learned so many different things about how, you know, just going through my case here, going through my exoneration process, that I'm like, how could these things happen and nobody, and not only that, but speaking to other exonerees and saying, how could something so obvious right in front of your face have escaped you? You guys do this for a living. Come on. But then again, I also can understand how difficult it is to believe an individual when they're telling you they're innocent, because people, I mean, I got tired of telling people in prison that I was innocent, because everybody would tell me, oh, yeah, me too. Oh, yeah, me too. I said, oh, my God, no wonder nobody believes me. No wonder. So it's tough like that. But I mean, it's so unfortunate that the bad police work, the bad lawyering that happens in our society. I mean, I'm a firm believer that if you go into public service, you join the district attorney's office, you join the police department, you're going to work for the public, uphold the public's interests first. But it obviously doesn't happen all the time.
So can you tell me, I don't ask about this a lot, but you said it was okay. Can you tell me how compensation or settlements work in California?
Well, it has gotten a whole lot better recently. I am grateful that I was able to receive some compensation. At the time that I received my compensation, it was 2014. I was under the old law where they paid $100 a day for every day that you sat in prison. For some reason, some genius up in the legislature decided that county jail time did not count, you know, but only prison time counted. So I received $100 a day for the time while I was in prison only, not the county jail, or after I was released from prison. I was also sent back to a county jail and held by the immigration because they were trying to deport me because I was not an American citizen. I was only a legal permanent resident. So I didn't get compensated for that. I wasn't compensated for all of the money I had spent on attorneys or even worse, the money that I had to pay. After I got out, I went to the child support office to tell them, I'm out. Here I am. I like to start paying my child support because my ex-wife and I weren't together. So I stood up, and what did they send me? A letter saying, now that we found you, you owe 3 years retroactive because the law, even though you were gone for 9 years, the law states that you have to pay for the last 3 years upon us finding you. I had to write them a letter back and put it in all caps. Excuse me, but you didn't find me. I walked into your office. I told you this. Nevertheless, I had to pay 3 years of retroactive child support with interest. And I said, oh, my God, you know. And I was hoping, okay, well, you know, I put that in because we had to fill out a big application for compensation that I had to do with my attorneys. Because I say attorneys plural because I had my original attorney and his son is also a practicing attorney. So he was helping him in his office at the time. And he did a lot of the case. They went through this huge application process with me. And they asked all these little questions. Well, you know, what money was spent here, there, and everywhere. And I pointed that out. But obviously, there was no compensation for that or any of the other countless amounts of money that your family has to spend on traveling all these long distances to visit you and, you know, and spend it on hotels, et cetera, et cetera. It's ridiculous. So I was compensated $100 a day for just the prison time. And my attorney received a third of that, you know. And like I told him, I'm more than happy to give you this one third because, like I told you from the outset, I wasn't out for any compensation. I wasn't out for any type of retaliation or anything. I just wanted to clear my name. That's all I wanted to do because I wanted to be able to live a decent life without having this past behind me. And so since then, I believe it was January of 2016 that the laws were changed, that now the price has been increased to $140 a day, and not only is prison time compensated, but so is county jail time. And that can mean a lot. I mean, that means a huge, that's a lot of money to a lot of people, especially a person who's just been released. But to me, I wasn't trying to fight for compensation at first. That wasn't my intention, because I had been out for so long fighting and working, fighting for my innocence and working at the time. But so obviously, and my wife and I were both working, so the compensation assisted. Of course it did, because we have two children in private universities. So obviously that helps. It's paying for their education. But if I was just recently paroled or exonerated and released straight from prison, that money I would have needed it even more.
So your goal was to live a regular life. Are you doing that?
Absolutely. You know, not only was I blessed, and a lot of people look at me when I say that and they say, well, how can you tell me that you were blessed and you were in prison? I go, I may have been in prison. My body may have been in prison, but my mind wasn't. Therefore, I educated myself. Therefore, I was able to learn. If there's nothing that I learned that stuck with me more than anything, was the fact that the thought of learning, that you never stop learning. So the fact that I learned that education was a lifelong process, I therefore took that to heart, and I have espoused it, and I will do so for the rest of my life. I will continue educating myself. So I earned my degree while I was in there. After receiving my compensation, I was fortunate enough to have the money to return to school and earn my master's degree. And I am working as a professional in the high tech field. And that's what I do today. I now have four children because I remarried after being released, and I have two sons with my current wife. And, you know, we have made sure that we had taught our children that education comes first and to become professionals, not just because we don't want them to be criminals like the criminals, you know, lifestyle that I had to be raised in, if you will, but because, I mean, it's the proper way to live life. I mean, to leave this planet better than where we found it. But I wasn't that, my level of consciousness was not at that level, you know, prior to going to prison. I had to be educated in order to, you know, to come to that realization.
You're very well spoken and you sound very educated. I would never, you know, some people when they speak are more rough, but you definitely sound like a very educated, a very motivated, a very smart individual. So good for you. Good for you for overcoming all of that.
Thank you very much. And I'm not the only one. I mean, there are a lot of men, and I'm sure women, but I wouldn't know because I've never been in a woman's prison, who are struggling, whether they be innocent or not, to try to improve upon their lot in life. And they're looking for a way out, and they're looking for an education. And I heard that like a year after I earned my bachelor's degree, that the prison systems just shut it down. They said no more college degrees for convicts. And I remember when we were going through our graduation that the general public was being interviewed and asked what they were asking the general public, you know, what do you think of this? And the general public, a lot of folks were angry. How could you do this? We have to pay for our children's education. How could you be educating convicts, da 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 da? Again, better, and it's much cheaper to educate a person on the inside, because they're going to be released at a later date, and you want an educated individual in our society who can contribute to our society, as opposed to a person who's going to continue in crime. That does not make sense. So there are a lot of good men in there. And again, I go back to what I said earlier, that a lot of people also argue that you shouldn't be educating lifers because it's a waste of money. They're never going to get out. Guess what? The majority are going to get out. And guess what? The majority of those lifers, and because the majority of the guys that I did go to school with were lifers, and they were some of the most intelligent, hardworking, you know, individuals, and some of the most humble, just good, outright people. Sure, they committed a crime. They killed somebody for whatever reason. It doesn't matter what crime they committed. They have changed their life. And if that is what the word rehabilitation means, then they have taken it upon themselves to become rehabilitated, to become educated. It is much cheaper to educate an incarcerated individual than it is to keep them in a prison cell at $100,000 or so. And this is an old figure that I had read many decades ago, that it cost like it was cheaper to send a person to Harvard than it was to incarcerate them at $90,000 a year. So if it is cheaper to do so, let's educate more people, because there are plenty of men and women who are willing to be educated so that they can make something of themselves upon release.
So my listeners email me a lot, and they ask me, what can the regular person, what can the non-attorney do to help? What do you think that the people can do to help?
A regular person can do so much more that they may not even be aware of. A regular citizen is always called to serve jury duty. When you're called to serve jury duty, please drink some coffee. Don't sleep through the jury, please. I mean, that's just one little example. But if the general public were able to understand that the man or the woman sitting up there being charged for a crime could actually be innocent, and they're not just walking into a jury with a preconceived notion that perhaps this person is innocent, they're just trying to sneak their way out of it. If you walk into a jury believing that, you're already 90% sure that this person is going, you're going to find this person guilty. Please, the general public, if you could please, if nothing else, listen to a podcast like this. Educate yourself on the fact that there are innocent men and women throughout this planet, not just this country, not just this state, throughout the planet, who are being falsely accused and falsely incarcerated because the jury believes they already have a preconceived notion that, you know, a person is guilty and therefore they're just trying to get out. Please be a little more thoughtful. Be a little more open-minded, and prepare yourself that when you're sitting up on that jury, a person can actually be innocent. And when these bills come, when we go to vote, read the bills, read between the lines. I mean, not all legislation that comes before you is black and white. There's a lot of gray areas. Please read it, educate yourself, because you never know what you could be voting on. I mean, just not too long ago, we voted to uphold the death penalty in this state. Unbelievable. I just can't fathom the thought that in today's day and age, people still can believe that we can continue to kill somebody because they killed somebody. You know, it goes against every principle that this country was founded on. It goes against everything that the Christian religion is founded on, that's for sure. Because I know that when I was religious and I went to Sunday school, I was taught that thou shalt not kill. But yet our government turns around and kills other individuals. There's something wrong with that picture. So I guess I just beg of the general public, the regular voting citizen, educate yourself before you go to the voting booth. Educate yourself before you call to sit on a jury, you know, on a jury. You never know who that other individual is whether that person, regardless of that person's gender, nationality, ethnicity, we are all human beings. We all shed the same blood. Treat that individual with the respect that you would if that individual sitting up on that jury was your child, your parent, your lover. I don't care. Give them some respect. Give them some. If you're going to sit in the jury anyways, hear it out. Don't just, you know, do like that gentleman who just sat there and slept throughout my jury. I was going to say I wish I could meet that man to ask him, but it's not going to change anything. It's not going to change. I mean, my change I made within me. I looked within me and made my change for myself. That's the only thing that I can say for anybody else and any other guys, whether you be guilty or not. If you're sitting on, or any guy or gal, if you're sitting on the inside and you're doing time, educate yourself from day one, because it's going to help you while you're inside. It's going to help you to formulate a better thought process. It'll allow you to make better decisions in prison and out. It'll better prepare you for the free world, so that you can get in on the better paying jobs, if you will. So that, and even if you didn't work, you know, even if you got out and you're 100 years old and you can't work and you're collecting Social Security, it doesn't hurt you to be an educated individual, so that you can have, so that you don't, if anything, if nothing more, you're not passing judgment on others blindly because somebody else told you this is the way it is. Somebody else is making decisions for you. Get out there and educate yourselves. Why, if in prison or not, it will help you both inside and outside the bars.
That was amazing. I don't have any more questions. Do you have anything else that you'd like to talk about?
Sure. I was just mentioning how if you're doing time, to educate yourself. But to my brothers and sisters that may be incarcerated for something you didn't do, I cannot say it enough. Please, please do not ever give up on yourself. Do not ever give up on hope, because, and even if you're paroled, you know, and you have your freedom, you're really not truly free until you get that strike off your record, until you have that nightmare off of your mind. It's never going to be erased from your mind. This nightmare is not erased from my mind. As I mentioned, I'm only in therapy now. And that's another thing. That's another part of what this compensation is doing. It's nothing but blood money. It's paying for therapy so that I can live a peaceful life, so that I can try to clear my mind. So the nightmare never goes away. At least you can at least have it struck from the record. Never give up. Please never give up. Always persevere.
I'm Brooke. Thanks so much for listening. A special thanks to our sponsors for supporting today's episode. Remember, if you can't financially help our sponsors, you can still give them a thank you shout out on social media. Visit our website, actualinpod.com, for more information, and check out our new podcast, Convicted, on your favorite podcast app. Our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks again, and always, for listening.